Are we moving to the portrait area? So let's see, where can I put this?
We have some portraits on the back wall. On the left is John Humphrey Noyes. Next to him is his legal wife, Harriet Holton Noyes. So sometimes people are surprised to find out that many community members were legally married. In their writings, they describe this as marriage as a good training ground for complex marriage, and also a good way of making sure their community was staying on the right side of the law, particularly after their challenges in Vermont.
That's Molly Jessup, curator at the Oneida Mansion House Museum. I interviewed her in the Great Hall of the Mansion House, which hosted meetings, concerts, and plays. Molly and I are standing at the back as we talk, underneath the portraits of John Humphrey Noyes and the other community founders. Molly explained that those challenges in Vermont were the result of Noyes' infatuation for one woman in particular, a woman who was not his wife. Her name was Mary Cragen.
The woman next to Harriet is Mary Cragen, who may look ordinary to us, but John Humphrey Noyes said she had an intoxicating spirit that could make a man crazy.
This black and white picture that Molly and I are looking at is the only surviving photo of Mary Cragen. In it, she wears a black gown with a starched collar. Her hair is parted in the middle and cropped short in the unisex fashion that Oneida women adopted. And she has wide-set eyes and an angular, almost chiseled face that wears a somber expression. In short, there's nothing in the photo to suggest the intoxicating sexuality that captivated so many men. I asked Molly if it was true that Noyes' lust for Mary Cragen jump-started the whole Oneida Utopian project.
My understanding is the beginning of the complex marriage is really because, at least in practice, was because John Humphrey Noyes wanted to have sex with Mary Cragen.
Yeah, so he was very drawn to her, and so drawn to her that he sort of wrote that this is God telling him to pursue something with this woman, that the time is right for complex marriage. So according to historians, Noyes expressed his feelings to Mary. She said she felt the same way. And then, not wanting to act immediately, they first then sat with their spouses and talked this over. And at that point, they all agreed to enter into complex marriage.
In an essay he wrote called My First Act in Sexual Freedom, Noyes described this crucial day with remarkable candor. According to his account, he and Mary were out walking when he was overcome with desire for her. And so they sat on a boulder alongside the path. And as Noyes describes it, all circumstances invited advance in freedom, and yielding to the impulse upon me, I took some personal liberties. But at this point came serious thoughts. I said to myself, I will not steal. I revolved in my mind, as before God, what to do. And when I thought of going home for confession and consultation with those who had rights in the case, I got a signal that that was the true thing to do. But Noyes could not even keep his hands off of Mary for the remainder of their walk. On the way back, he writes, we stopped once and took some liberty of embracing, and Mrs. Cragen distinctly gave me to understand that she was ready for the full consummation. But Noyes was intent on getting permission from both spouses. So when they returned home, the two couples met together. And at first, George Cragen objected. In episode 2, we told the story of how the Cragens came to join John Humphrey Noyes at Putney, Vermont. And you might remember that Noyes had invited the Cragens after learning that his disciple, Abram Smith, had been sleeping with Mary. George surely appreciated the bitter irony that his one-time rescuer and current spiritual mentor was now taking liberties with his wife. But Noyes and Mary eventually won George over, or at least they wore him down. And Noyes' essay ends this way. The upshot of the conference was that we gave each other full liberty all around, and so entered into complex marriage in the quartet form. The last part of the interview was as amicable and happy as a wedding, and a full consummation soon followed.
What did her What did her husband, George Cragen, think about all this?
George Cragen was also a perfectionist.
Is that him on the wall there?
No. So although
George didn't make the wall?
He didn't make the wall.
Oh, boy.
So that's what's always interesting. You know, as a historian, you look at these pieces of material culture and you say, well, what does this show us and why? And so only members of the Noyes family are seen in portrait, with the exception of Mary Cragen. So it's, again, that idea that some people are just more important than others. So the man next to Mary on the wall is not her husband, but is, in fact, John Humphrey Noyes' brother.
Really?
So Noyes had a brother and two sisters who joined the community. So Mary's husband was here. He doesn't make the portrait wall. It sounds to me, from reading about Mary Cragen, that she was really taking the lead in bringing them to the perfectionist practice. But that's not entirely uncommon in at that point in time, when women are really viewed as moral authorities in their home, and religion being an important aspect of what they share with their families.
The Noyes and Cragens initially kept their foursome secret, even from the other members of the Putney perfectionist community. But they gradually expanded the circle of complex marriage to include other couples. And as they did so, Noyes began to further develop his theology. One fascinating component of his ideas was the way he connected sex, electricity, and divinity. Ellen Wayland Smith, a historian and descendant of Noyes, explains.
He always thought of the body of Christ, the body of church, or the body of his believers, as sort of linked by an electrical magnetism or an electrical sort of pull linking everybody together. And so, you know, he would quite explicitly in his writings talk about Jesus as sort of the divine. He would compare Jesus to a divine battery who would charge his followers with his magnetism, and that the sort of spiritual, the spiritual fluid would flow from Jesus through his followers and would vivify the whole body of Christ, the whole body of his followers, and that you could pass this fluid on not only by touch, and so that accounted for Noyes' belief in faith healing.
What was his track record as a healer?
Not so good. A friend of theirs, who was not part of the community, was desperate because his wife was sick, and he had tried everything and couldn't be healed. And so John Humphrey Noyes stepped up and said, maybe I can heal her. And that one seemed to work. The first one seemed to work. He and Mary Cragen went into the sick woman's room and held hands with her, and she apparently walked out of the room and was never sick again. But then he tried it again a couple weeks later with another girl who was suffering from tuberculosis, and she died.
But whatever the townspeople of Putney thought of Noyes' shortcomings and strengths as a healer, when they learned about the perfectionist's extraordinary sexual experimentation, they were unanimously opposed. Ellen Wayland Smith explains.
So he decided to leave Putney because actually the husband of the woman he had healed, whether he was disgruntled or whatever it was, started to tell the other villagers about the unorthodox sexual arrangements of the Putney community. So up until that point, they were a group of maybe 30 people who were sort of living communally. The sexual sharing was actually only going on between, you know, three or four couples at that time. But when that news leaked to the villagers, who already thought they were sort of a strange group, the outrage was immediate.
The town's leading minister, Reverend Eastman, denounced Noyes. He called him a hydra-headed monster of sin, whose ideas about sex were as fatal to the moral principles of those who are brought fully under their power as the winds of the Sahara. And soon, the town elders were holding meetings, trying to agree on a way to drive Noyes and his followers out. At first, Noyes thought that these threats were just so much hot air. He was, after all, trained as a lawyer and theologian, and so he actually welcomed the opportunity to debate his ideas. Indeed, when the sheriff arrested him for adultery, Noyes was so pleased that his sister wrote to their mother and said, "If you have ever seen him with a radiant countenance, walking with elastic buoyancy, his cane raised in flourish, relating some glorious adventure, you have some idea of the scene. He was in duress about 4 hours, and had opportunity to parry wit with the lawyers. He told them it was a controversy of principles, and would have to be settled at last by priests and philosophers." Noyes made bail and was released feeling triumphant. But soon word came to him that some in the town were contemplating mob action. That was a different matter altogether. This was, after all, just 2 years after Joseph Smith was murdered in Nauvoo, Illinois. Noyes had an amazing ability to turn almost any defeat into a victory. And even as he was being chased out of the community he'd built, from Putney to the town of Brattleboro, 16 miles away, he exulted. John Miller, a member of the community who went with him, recalled, "Mr. Noyes danced across the room and, snapping his fingers and laughing heartily, said, 'We shall beat the devil at this game.'" The next day, the Cragans fled Putney as well, leaving town at 2 a.m. This must have been an incredibly stressful time for the Cragans. It was already late October, and the New England nights were long and bitingly cold, and the Cragans had chosen to leave their three eldest children behind in Putney, in the care of other perfectionists who hadn't participated in the complex marriage experiment, and so were at less risk. But the Cragans did bring their baby boy with them. Indeed, Mary had given birth to twins just 2 months before. But the girl, Victoria, had died after just 3 days. And while Victor survived, he had in fact been sired not by George, but rather by John Humphrey Noyes. As he grew up, his facial features were so distinctly Noyesian that everyone acknowledged his true parentage, even George, and he eventually changed his last name from Cragan to Noyes. The Noyeses and Cragans stayed in Brattleboro for more than 2 months, hoping that the storm in Putney would pass. But when it became clear that Putney remained stubbornly hostile to the perfectionists, Noyes began searching for a new home. In central New York, there was a perfectionist convert named Jonathan Burt, who had purchased a big swath of land from the Oneida tribe. Just the previous year, Burt had invited three other perfectionist families to settle there with him. When Burt reached out to Noyes, Noyes visited to assess whether it would be a suitable site. The conditions there were primitive, to be sure, with the perfectionists huddling together in a crude shanty. And they made a living, such as it was, operating a sawmill they'd purchased from the Oneida Native Americans. But Noyes was a dreamer, and he saw possibilities. For one thing, there were other farms for sale nearby, which would make expansion possible. And in addition to the material conditions, Noyes used his visit to be sure that the community there would accept him as their unconditional leader. After a long meeting with Jonathan Burt, his host, Noyes wrote to George Cragan, "I have the confidence of all now on the ground. They see for themselves that my tyranny is highly useful." A few weeks later, John Humphrey Noyes' wife, Harriet, and their son, Theodore, and the Cragan family, this time with all of their children in tow, took a train to Oneida Depot, a few miles from the Burt homestead. It was still winter, and they were met by horse-drawn sleighs, which carried the party over the frozen landscape to join Noyes in what his wife Harriet called the howling wilderness. But if the landscape was daunting, the communards were passionate and willing to work hard. And as news of the nascent community spread, Oneida became a beacon for perfectionists from all over New York and New England. And the people that flocked there were overwhelmingly young, vigorous, competent, and practical. There were artisans and craftspeople, printers and architects, metalsmiths and machinists. And these early recruits were eager to build God's kingdom right there on the plains of New York. The chief attraction for most was the promise of economic communism. It was widely believed in the American perfectionist community of the 1840s that the first apostles had lived in economic communism. Perhaps the most cited passage of the New Testament
among these perfectionists. It comes from the book of Acts, chapter 2, which describes how the first apostles lived. And all that believed were together and had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods, and parted them to all men, as every man had need. A fascinating coincidence, or at least a strange quirk of history, is that the New York Oneida Commune began in 1848, the very year that Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto. Noyes was, of course, familiar with Marxist and socialist thought, but he found it to be completely impoverished, because while Marxism aimed to address the terrible inequalities and working conditions that Charles Dickens chronicled in his fiction, so-called scientific socialism had literally nothing to say about either humanity's spiritual needs or the crisis in modern family life that we chronicled in episode 3. Noyes explained his views this way. When the spirit of truth pricked 3,000 men to the heart and converted them on the day of the Pentecost, its next effect was to resolve them into one family and introduced communism of property. Thus, the greatest of all revivals was also the great inauguration of socialism. The first task for these converts who were eager to experience communism was building a home big enough to house them all. And this was no small task, because by the end of 1848, there were 87 people living at Oneida. Fortunately, one of them was Erastus Hamilton, an experienced architect. Under his direction, the communards, both male and female, began construction of a massive building that they called the Mansion House. It was 3 stories high and contained meeting rooms, giant kitchens and laundries, and dormitory-style sleeping quarters on the 3rd floor. But it would take time to finish that 3rd floor, and it wasn't ready for the winter of 1848-49. And so for those cold months, the whole community crammed into a single large room on the 2nd floor, which they divided up by hanging sheets from the ceiling. But rather than discouraging the communards, the tough conditions bonded them, and for decades, those who had lived there regaled new converts with stories of how their buoyant spirits had allowed them to keep going despite the tough conditions. From its very beginnings, Oneida was guided and governed by a few clear general principles, including communal property, complex marriage, a radical rethinking of gender roles, and regulation of behavior through mutual criticism. But Noyes also made a key decision, which was to avoid writing down or issuing any specific rule book or constitution. The often bitter experience of other utopian communities shows that there was wisdom in this. Noyes was a keen student of other utopian communities. Indeed, he actually authored a book on the subject called A History of American Socialism. And too frequently, as historian Chris Jennings notes in Paradise Now, His History of American Intentional Communities, small utopias suffocate under reams of bylaws. And Noyes believed that a written code would stifle the creativity needed to adjust to changing and unpredictable circumstances. And although Noyes demanded complete loyalty, and he could at times be authoritarian, he also recognized that he didn't have a monopoly on good ideas. As Chris Jennings notes, while Noyes generally had the final word on matters of religious doctrine, most major decisions, what type of home to build, which industries to pursue, where to dig the privy, were settled by lively community-wide debate. Meetings were held daily, and consensus was the constant goal. Crucially, after a false start, Noyes deferred to those with more knowledge and expertise when it came to the commercial side of Oneida. Noyes's original vision was to build the economic foundation of Oneida on the growing and selling of fruit. In some ways, this was the obvious path. Horticulture was a common and crucial feature of many mid-19th century utopian communities. And in a way, this makes sense. After all, it was the disruption of the old customs and habits caused by the rise of the market economy and the Industrial Revolution that had sent so many people searching for answers in the first place. The Shakers were a great influence on Noyes, and their founder, Mother Ann Lee, for example,
was born in Manchester, England, the very birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, and she was greatly shaped by the Dickensian conditions that followed directly from the construction of the world's first factories. So perhaps it was natural that many utopian communities were based on nostalgia for the simpler agrarian lifestyle of yore. Indeed, two of the most famous 19th century communes wore this nostalgia right on their sleeves. One of these, Brook Farm, was immortalized by Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was a founding member, in his novel called The Blithedale Romance. And the other, called Fruitlands, was based on transcendental principles and was chronicled in a book by Louisa May Alcott. But if Fruitlands and Brook Farm were famous, they were famous failures. The socialist agricultural model may have sounded promising to these 19th century idealists, but in truth, the model didn't work much better in New England than it did a century later in Russia or China. Fruitlands winked out within a few months of its opening, while Brook Farm lasted only a couple years. And of course, Noyes was aware of these failures. Still, initially, the siren-like appeal of a bucolic agrarian life was too much for him to resist. Historian Anthony Wunderlich, who's just written a new book called Oneida Utopia, explains why Noyes thought agriculture would make the best foundation for his social experimentation.
The Oneida community was originally based its behavior and its social relations and indeed even its economy around what they called horticulture, and this was the idea that they could make their subsistence from tree fruits, from garden vegetables, and from berries and grapes growing on bushes, and to a large extent in the early years they did. It was a way of life that encouraged men and women and children to work together, and to a large extent, they developed gender relations that were unusually equal, at least in relation to the Victorian society around them.
And yet, economically, Noyes' scheme to grow fruit was not much more successful than the failed experiments at Brook Farm and Fruitlands. Under Noyes' direction, in 1849, the communards planted cherry, plum, and pear trees. But of course, fruit trees take years to grow, and the windy, cold climate of New York was not particularly hospitable. The commitment to agriculture threatened to destroy the whole experiment. As one communard put it, our horticultural flag had been nailed to the mast, and sink or swim, we were going to do our best to make a success of fruit growing. In the meantime, the communards tried to scratch out a living in a variety of ways. They made gold chains and carpet bags. They sent salesmen out into the world, hawking fabrics and textiles. But mostly, they spent down the resources that some of their wealthier members had chipped in to the common pool. At one point, things got so dire that 40 members pawned their watches. And to make ends meet, the kitchen served only basic fare, like bread, milk, and potatoes. In the end, the community's salvation came from an unlikely source, a man named Sewell Newhouse. Again, here's historian Anthony Wunderlich.
Well, Sewell Newhouse is our local Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, in the sense that there are a tremendous number of local anecdotes, stories, told about him as they were about frontiers people in other districts, where he is always the hero of interacting with Native Americans in contests of strength, of racing, and things like that. He was a person who was, as a very young person, he was brought here, I believe, in the 1820s, and he grew up in the area. He spent a lot of his time roaming the outdoors, and so he certainly got to know the Oneida Indians. How much of any of the local colorful anecdotes are true is impossible to tell, but it is so that an Oneida chief who led the migration of local Native Americans to Wisconsin in the 1820s, many years later, came back to visit Sewell Newhouse here in the Mansion House and they sat together and reminisced in the Oneida language.
Hmm. And so Newhouse was the inventor of some very significant animal traps. Can you talk about what was different or special about the traps he built?
In Newhouse's day, most animal traps were imported from Germany and from Great Britain. And Newhouse apparently was unhappy with their quality, and he himself developed a kind of trap that was more durable, and it resisted the winter cold, the brittle breaking. And so his traps became widely known locally, and he was able to build up a following and make something of a living as a blacksmith in a village near here named Oneida Castle, where he could, by hand forging, turn out perhaps 1,500 traps a year.
And was that a surprise to John Humphrey Noyes that the community turned to making traps so quickly? Was that something he'd envisioned, or how did he react to this idea of becoming a trap manufacturer?
Well, Newhouse came to the Oneida community early, in late 1848, that is, the end of the first year of the community here in the along Oneida Creek, and for a number of years was put to work clearing swamps and not making traps. And whether or not that was by design or accident is not clear. They may have been testing his mettle, testing his commitment to the commonality. By accident, in the very early 1850s, an order arrived for traps, and Newhouse and several other of the Oneida community people set to work to make them. They manufactured a couple hundred for, I think, Chicago. And they were an immediate success, and at that point, it came to everybody's attention that traps were a potentially lucrative way to go. And might offer the community a real sound financial future.
Indeed, as word of mouth spread about the quality of Newhouse's traps, sales zoomed. The Hudson Bay Company started placing massive orders, and Newhouse just couldn't keep up with demand. Fortunately, he agreed to let the other communards tinker with his production process. And it just so happened that there were several ingenious machinists and metalworkers at Oneida, and soon they devised a system that was pumping out 100,000 traps a year by 1860 and 275,000 by 1865. This bonanza of sales meant that the company was now awash with money. And this was, of course, fundamentally good news. It meant that Oneida would not succumb to financial ruin or deprivation, as Fruitlands and Brook Farm had. The lean years were over for good, and a new era of abundance had begun. The food improved dramatically, and now there was time for leisure, for the sorts of pursuits, the arts, music, science, that made the community so attractive, both to its residents like Harriet Warden, but also to outsiders as well. Still, in some ways, wealth was a double-edged sword. Despite its many benefits, the wealth of the community also, subtly and slowly at first, began to undermine the shared sense of mission of the communards. Again, Anthony Wunderly.
This was not a big capitalist analysis, at least the way they tell it. Over and over again, they say they decided that they had to ramp up production because they had too many orders and they didn't want to disappoint the customers. So at that point, in the little mill near here, they had perhaps 40 temporary workers working shoulder to shoulder with the perfectionists, madly, frantically turning out traps. And they made a conscious decision at that point in time, in the early 1860s, to hire employees full time to be able to make more traps. And at that point, they bought a property about a mile north of here that offered what they believed was greater water power, and they constructed a factory dedicated to trap making. And in that factory, they actually hired full-time employees who were, in essence, turning traps out assembly line fashion. They had entered the industrial early on, these folks were complete communists in the sense that in the Oneida community, everything was shared. All work, all property, all love, and all responsibility. And early on, John Noyes had thundered at the capitalistic class of America, take your workers into your home, go back to the old way, stop exploiting these folks. And now all of a sudden they found themselves in precisely that situation. And it was a conundrum to them because they could not in the end justify being capitalistic employers and communists at the same time. And their solution to it was human kindness. It was not logic. They began to define their capitalist situation as an opportunity to help other people in another way. Hypocritical as that may sound to us, they believed that they could provide jobs and help workers have better lives. And so they dedicated themselves to becoming the kindest, most liberal, capitalistic employers in the region.
And that must have been good politically as well, right? They must have made allies by paying good wages and hiring local people.
The Oneida community always had their eye to good public relations. This was a time period of, you used the word cult earlier. And cult to me means a group of people who are practicing typically a religion out of the mainstream, relatively few people. And in our time, cults have been led almost entirely by young, charismatic males who always turn out to be up to some mischief. That was the case then, too. And it was, to a certain extent, it was the case with the Oneida community. But in the Oneida case was some difference. A number of cults at that time, coming out of the same place and the same issues and religious excitements, were in fact coming up against public relations problems. The clearest example of that is the Mormons, who come out of the burnt district, that is central New York, at the same time as the Oneida community. And all during these years of the Oneida community, the Mormons were being driven out, tarred and heeled, lynched left and right, going on to the next place, and then angering the next group of people, until finally they ended up in Utah. The Oneida community made that mistake once, early on, in around Noyes' group, where they started in Putney, Vermont. They angered the local townspeople after a while. When that group emigrated to Oneida Creek to join up with other local perfectionists from upstate New York as well as New England, they always had an eye to good public relations after that, and they always got along well with their neighbors.
Their good PR paid off handsomely during the Civil War. By rights, the Oneida community should have thrown its lot in wholeheartedly for the Union side. After all, as a youth, Noyes had been an anti-slavery campaigner, and he styled himself as a liberator, not just of Southern slaves, but of all oppressed peoples. But by the time of the war, his attention had shifted, and he'd begun to view slavery as a symptom, rather than the cause of, the nation's estrangement from God. And so, he did not believe it was wise to tackle slavery head-on, as the abolitionists were doing. Rather, Noyes argued that if he could bring the nation to God, then sins such as slavery would inevitably wither away. And so, when the Civil War came, the Oneidans were sympathetic to the Union cause, but only to a point. The community newspaper, The Circular, put it like this: "We consider ourselves fellow conscripts with the new-made soldiers, but drawn to serve in a different field. Indeed, we have been in camp for the last 16 years, pioneering in a grand struggle against worse foes to the common welfare than the Southern Secesh." This was, of course, nonsense. Offensive nonsense. Chattel slavery was an almost incomparable form of injustice, and by no standard were the Oneida Communard soldiers. Indeed, by 1863, when this article was published, thousands of men were dying each week for the Union cause, sacrificing their lives, whether they liked it or not, to the terrible conflagration over slavery. And there were about 150 fit, healthy young men at Oneida who could have lent a hand to the Union cause, and who, after the imposition of the draft, by rights should have done so. But because of a remarkably lucky surveying error, the communards wound up being completely exempt. Anthony Wunderly explains.
When the first draft took effect in, I think, 1863, Oneida, not by design but by accident, was exempted from the call-up. And it was because of their peculiar position between the counties here. Oneida Creek winds around this place. It's called the land between the bridges. It's a magical place. One side is one county, but not obviously so, and the other side is the other county. And what apparently happened was that the agent for the draft from each county overlooked it, believing that it was in the other's jurisdiction. And it caused a certain amount of resentment at the time among locals. They said it was damn Oneida luck or community luck. That's the way it always went with the community. The community offered the authorities to draw over. And, of course, the people who had already been through the draft and had not been selected vetoed that immediately. So it was never happened. And if there was another draft, some of them say yes and some of them say no. Again, they escaped. They did, however, offer to support the war in a number of ways. One of them was to pay the conscription fees. It was common practice during the Civil War, during the first installment of the draft, for people to be able to buy their way out if they were selected. The interpretation was that if you are drafted, what the real necessity is that you provide someone, if not your own body, then someone else's body. And so typically, fees would be paid for enrollment. But more to the point, they also began, about this time, they were well into industrialization, sounding like business people, and they said over and over again, we have paid our share of taxes for the war effort. Over and over and over and over again. So we've done our fair share.
But to those dying in the war, the idea that you could skip it if you were rich enough or lucky enough or just because you'd paid some taxes was beyond offensive. Indeed, the Union effort was hampered by class divisions. The ability to buy your way out of the war, as the Oneida Communards did, made it very much a rich man's war, but a poor man's fight. In 1863, the same year as that smug editorial and the Oneida Circular, these resentments boiled over in New York City as anti-draft protests metastasized into race riots that left over 100 African Americans dead. This was the biggest civil disturbance in all of American history. Still, if Oneida had its share of contradictions, it also had countless strengths. By the 1860s, it was financially sound, stable, by and large at peace with its neighbors, and generally speaking, a happy place. Because of the ingenuity and business acumen of its people, the communards had managed to escape both the nostalgia for the past that doomed other utopian experiments and the worst excesses of early industrial capitalism. Oneida was, in short, in many ways an oasis, standing apart from the turbulence of 19th century America. As a group, the communards were probably as free as anyone from dangerous and difficult labor. They were able to pursue arts and culture, and certainly their ability to share sex and love with literally hundreds of people was unmatched. As we've seen, the population of Oneida was filled with competent, ingenious, and talented people. But the Oneida experiment was so unusual that the commune also attracted lots of eccentric personalities and fringe characters. John Humphrey Noyes and the other communards tried hard to make sure that the people they let in were a good fit. And mostly, they did a good job at this. But on at least one occasion, they failed spectacularly, and the man they mistakenly let in changed the course of American history.
That's next time on American Utopia.